Chapter 11 of the book of Revelation is one of the most fascinating chapters to me in the book. And it's a chapter where we really have to kind of hone our interpretive skills, because there are a lot of issues you have to deal with in this chapter that really bring into play one's hermeneutic, if you're going to be consistent through the book. And if you've been with us these other sessions, you'll know we've been talking about these interludes. And chapter 11 here is another one of these interludes. It continues from chapter 10, and it's an interlude between the sixth and the seventh of these trumpet judgments. Just as there was an interlude between the sixth seal and the seventh seal judgments, we've had the first six of these trumpet judgments, and we'll actually have the seventh trumpet judgment here at the end of chapter 11. So the material we have at the first part of the chapter here is still part of this interlude, or kind of this intermission, or some more fill-in material about some events that are taking place. And I call chapter 11 the temple, the two witnesses, and the trumpet, because that's really what it's about. The first two verses are about a temple. The verses 3 through 14 are about these two witnesses. And then the last part of the chapter, verses 15 to 19, are about the trumpet, the seventh trumpet, when it sounds. The first two verses of chapter 11 are about a temple. And John says this. He says, "There was given me a measuring rod like a staff, and someone said, 'Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. And leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it's been given to the nations, for they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. Now, the big question here is what temple is this talking about? What's the temple here that's referred to? And there, as you can imagine, there are several different views of this, but I'll just give the three main ones of what this temple is. The first one is what we would call the symbolic view. And that is that the temple here represents the church. Those who hold this view would say that the temple in Revelation 11, 1 and 2 is the church, and the court is the world and all who've compromised with it, kind of on the outside. So this is a picture of the church. And of course, this comes from the fact that in the New Testament, the church is referred to symbolically as a temple. There are a lot of different metaphors used for the church, and where the bride of Christ, we're the branches, he's the vine, he's the shepherd, we're the sheep. And Jesus Christ refers to us, the church, as a temple. So based on that imagery, they'd say, well, this is just a picture here of the church of Jesus Christ during this time of tribulation, the church being measured by God during this period of time. There are a couple problems with this to me. One is, the entire context of this chapter, chapter 11, is Jewish. It's referring to a temple, the outer court. We go on down and read about these two witnesses who are clothed in sackcloth. We see that their bodies lie in the street of Jerusalem. So the whole context of this chapter is about the land of Israel. It's about the city of Jerusalem. It's about witnesses dressed in sackcloth. So it seems to be an entirely Jewish context in this chapter. To introduce the church into that seems to me to not fit the context. The other problem, the main one to me, is this. If the sanctuary here represents the church, then who are the favored worshipers who were measured? Because the church, after all, is the people. So if the sanctuary is the church, then the worshipers here within this are being measured, who are favored by God. Who are these favored worshipers who are being measured? To me, it kind of mixes the metaphor together a bit. So I don't take the idea that this temple that's mentioned here is the church. A second view that's held by preterists is that this is the second Jewish temple. This is the Herodian temple that was still standing, because preterists believe the book of Revelation was written in about 65 or 66 AD. It's a prophecy primarily about the Jewish war and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So they, the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. So they would say, well, this is describing the temple that's still standing during that time period. Because obviously it was written in the 60s, the temple is still there. And they would say, obviously, this is that second Jewish temple that was standing during that time. Because remember, the first Jewish temple was the Solomonic temple. It was built by Solomon. It was destroyed in 586 by the Babylonians. When the remnant came back, they built another temple. The glory of God never came and filled that second temple. And it was embellished greatly by Herod. Remember, all the embellishments and all the rebuilding of it was all finally finished in 64 AD. 6 years later, it was destroyed by the Romans. So that's the temple they would say is being spoken of here in this passage. The view that I take, though, is the futurist view that this is a tribulation temple. Part of the reason for that is if you just go on through this chapter, it is very difficult to make the rest of the events of this chapter fit with the events of 70 AD. To take this temple here as the Herodian temple, the second temple, and then to go on and cause the rest of the events here to fit in with that. And so I take this to be a future temple. You say, well, on what grounds can you do that? Well, remember, John is writing here, and he is following the pattern of many of the Old Testament prophets. Remember, Ezekiel was writing during the time of the Babylonian captivity. In Ezekiel 40 to 48, he describes a massive temple there that clearly wasn't on the earth at the time he was writing. And remember, Daniel, during his time, he writes about a temple and sacrifices being offered. When Daniel is writing, there's no temple in Jerusalem. So both Ezekiel and Daniel write about temples that are future to their day. So we could easily expect John here to do the same thing. One of the things that's interesting to me here about this temple is this is another reenactment of one of Ezekiel's visions. Remember in chapter 10, John reenacts the eating of a scroll, the same thing that Ezekiel had done. And Ezekiel measures a temple in Ezekiel 40 to 48. Here we have John doing the same thing. And it's also fascinating to me here, John actually comes now and participates in one of the visions. He's there measuring this temple. But when he says here, this temple is going to be trodden underfoot by the nations for 42 months. This is the first use of this time period in the book of Revelation. And 42 months is 3.5 years. I take it here, it's the last half of the tribulation period, because you go back to Luke chapter 21, verse 24, Jesus talks about Jerusalem being trodden under by the Gentiles until that time of the Gentiles is ultimately going to be fulfilled. And so I see this as the treading underfoot of Jerusalem and the temple area for 42 months. Because remember, the Jews are going to have a treaty with Antichrist for the first half of that 3.5 years. And he's going to break the covenant in the midpoint, according to Daniel 9:27. So this would be the last half of that 70th week of Daniel, or that 7 year period when the temple here is going to be trodden underfoot. Now, the next thing we're introduced to in this chapter is the two witnesses. And you'll notice in verse 3, he says, I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days. The 1,260 days is the same time period as 42 months. Use the Jewish prophetic calendar, a 360-day calendar, it's the same time period. And so, if the 42 months in verse 2 is the last half of the tribulation when the city of Jerusalem is being trodden underfoot, then I take it that the 1260 days in verse 3 is also the last half of the tribulation period. Now, a lot of people put the two witnesses in the first half of the tribulation. And there are a lot of attractive arguments for that view. But to me, the fact that 42 months and 1260 days are used right next to each other here, and it's clear that the 42 months is the last half, I think you need to make the 1260 the last half as well, just for the sake of consistency. Now, these two witnesses are mentioned here, and there are all kinds of views on who these two witnesses are. Notice they're going to be in sackcloth, and he says, these are two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. There's this symbolic view, and I've done some reading on this, and the primary view that I see out there today of this symbolic view is they say the two witnesses are just symbolic of the entire line of the prophets. You know, there has to be by the mouth of two or three witnesses a matter is confirmed. They just symbolize the entire line of the prophets, because when you go down here and read further, it says that they shut up the sky so that it doesn't rain. That's like what Elijah did. They turn the water to blood. That's like what Moses did. And they'll say, this is just symbolic of all the prophets here, these two witnesses. Others will say that they are believers during this period of time who are ministering and carrying out God's will. I mean, there's all kinds of different views. But all these symbolic views, they don't take them as two individuals. In other words, they're symbolic of some larger group. The other view is, if you take them as two literal individuals, which to me, that's the way I think you have to understand this. Witnesses are never spoken of in as groups of people. They're always individuals. They're martyrs, the word that's used there. Also, you notice it goes on down here. They perform miracles. Their bodies are killed. They lie in the street of Jerusalem for 3.5 days. Their bodies are raised up. They witness for the Lord during this period of time. To me, there's too many details in this passage to take this symbolically. It just seems to me, as you read it, it's referring to two individuals. Here's another thing that's very important. The background for this passage here about the two olive trees and the two lampstands is Zechariah chapter 4. And who are the olive trees and the lampstands back in Zechariah chapter 4? Well, they are Zerubbabel and Joshua. Remember, Joshua was the high priest and Zerubbabel was the civil leader. So the imagery we have here takes us back to the Old Testament to two individuals. So why would you then come in this passage that's referring back to two individuals and then come here and say, well, but this here is not two individuals, it's a group of people. Now, to me, the imagery from the Old Testament confirms the interpretation. These are two people. And you say, okay, if they're two people, then who are they? Well, a lot of people would say these are just two unknown individuals in the end times that God is going to raise up. Two end time prophets. We don't know who they are now, but God will raise them up in the end times to minister because they're not identified. So they're two individuals God will raise up at that time. That view could certainly be true. Others would say, no, these are Enoch and Elijah because they shut up the sky and it doesn't give rain. That's what Elijah did. And so there's a lot of things here similar to him. Elijah was a prophet. Elijah ministered during the dark days of Israel. They would say that Enoch, and of course Elijah didn't die, so he's got to come back to die. Others would say that Enoch is part of this too, because Enoch was in a terribly dark time of history before the flood. And Enoch was a prophet, according to the book of Jude. And so they see this as Enoch and Elijah. And part of the reason is they would say, well, Enoch and Elijah didn't die. And so they need to come back and die because the Bible says in Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to man once to die, and after that comes the judgment. Well, that statement in Hebrews 9:27, I take it as a general statement, because think about that, a whole generation of people at the rapture won't die. So the whole point of the rapture is we're going to do an end run on the grave and not die. Also, there's several people in the Bible who died twice. The son of the widow of Nain died twice. Lazarus died twice. So the statement, it's appointed to man once to die, and after that's the judgment, is just stating the general rule in Scripture. But it is interesting, many in the early church held the two witnesses were Enoch and Elijah. That was the most common view early on. Now, the view that I hold is that they're Elijah and Moses because of the similarity with the miracles they do. They shut up the sky like Elijah did. They turn water to blood as Moses did. And also remember, if you go back to the very end of Malachi chapter 4, Moses is mentioned there and Elijah is mentioned there. And it says that Elijah is going to come before that great and terrible day of the Lord. Then when you go to the Mount of Transfiguration, who are the two people who appear there with Jesus at the Mount of Transfiguration? It's Moses and Elijah. And that's kind of a little cameo picture or a foreshadow of the second coming of Jesus there. He has Moses and Elijah appearing there with him. So because of that, many believe this is Elijah and Moses, and I would hold to that view as well. And again, people say, well, now wait a minute. Then Elijah's going to come back and he's going to have to die, and then Moses is going to come back and he's going to die twice. Well, again, like I said, other people have died twice. Some people will not die at all. It's just a general rule that's being stated. Now, if that's true, think about how that's going to freak out Elijah and Moses to come back to a modern world and see these things. And think about how it's going to freak out the people in the world, these two Old Testament saints coming on the scene and bringing judgment. In verse 5, it says, if anyone desires to harm them, fire comes out of their mouth and devours their enemies. Now, this is one of these places where people often come and say, now, do you really take that literally? You claim to take the Bible literally. Are these guys going to literally be like human flamethrowers, you know, that throw fire out of their mouths? Well, I think something coming out of your mouth like that speaks of your words. Just like Jesus has a sharp sword out of his mouth, we don't really believe Jesus has a sword sticking out of his mouth. It pictures his word. And so what comes out of their mouth here, I think, is they're able to slay their enemies. And if anyone would desire to harm them in this manner, he must be killed. And they have power to shut up the sky in order that rain may not fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have power over the waters to turn them to blood and smite the earth with every plague as often as they desire. Now, part of my view here is I think that these two witnesses are going to be the ones that God uses to call down the trumpet judgments. Remember in the Old Testament, in the plagues, that Moses and Aaron would call these plagues forth. And so I think these two men may be the human instruments that God uses to call down the trumpet judgments. That's why they're so hated. We're going to see later on here, when they get killed, the whole world's going to celebrate their death. It's going to be Happy Dead Prophets Day, as someone put it at one time, as these two men are destroyed. So God may use these men in this dark hour to come and to call down these judgments. And again, I take this to be the second half of the tribulation, or the second half of the 70th week of Daniel, because that's the time when the Antichrist is going to be active, when his kingdom is going to be dominating the earth. And so Satan is going to have his two men, the beast and the false prophet, dominating the earth during that time. And God's going to have his two men, these two witnesses, who were able to come against them. Now notice in verse 7, but when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. Now I love that statement there. It's when they finish their testimony. They are immortal and indestructible till God's finished with them. Nobody can kill these two men, but it says when they finish their testimony, God is going to allow them to be killed. And I like to make an application to your life and my life in the fact that until God is finished with us, we're indestructible as well. It's what David Livingston, I think the great missionary, said one time. We're immortal until God's finished with us. That doesn't mean we go out and do foolish things or live a reckless life, but it should give us a comfort that whenever we leave this world, it's evidence to us that we finished our testimony that God has given to us. It should be a comfort to all of us in our lives. Their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city. Notice which mystically is called Sodom and Egypt. This is a very important interpretive issue here. Notice when God wants a geographical place for us to know that it's symbolic, he tells us. He says it's mystically called Sodom and Egypt, where their Lord was crucified. So he tells us this is where Jesus was crucified, so we know it's Jerusalem, but he says it's mystically called Sodom and Egypt. And I think it's called mystically called Sodom because of all of the perversity that's there of the worship of the Antichrist. And it's called mystically called Egypt because of the bondage of the people during the time of the tribulation period. But he's letting us know it's symbolic here, that it's symbolically being called or mystically called Sodom and Egypt. But clearly it's the city of Jerusalem. And those from the nations and tribes and tongues and peoples will look at their dead bodies for 3.5 days and will not permit their dead bodies to be laid in a grave. Those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry. They'll send gifts to one another because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. So again, that's why I think they may be used by God to call down these trumpet judgments, because it says they torment the people who are on the earth. And people are glad that these men have finally have been slain. It's interesting here. It says that peoples from the tribes and tongues and nations will look at their bodies for 3.5 days and not permit their dead bodies to be laid in a tomb. Some have wondered if this might be a reference to the technology we have today of people all over the earth to see this. You know, back at the time this was written, it'd be very difficult for all the peoples and tongues and nations to see this. But now with, you know, 24/7 cable news and television, these things, it's easy to see how this could happen. So this could even be another picture here of the kinds of things that are necessary for this prophecy to be fulfilled. One of the things I think here in this passage that's enlightening is this is the only time during the tribulation in the book of Revelation you see people making merry and celebrating. This is the only time here. And it's the death of these two prophets. Someone called this, again, as I said, a Happy Dead Prophets Day. They call this the Devil's Christmas. People are giving presents to one another because they're so happy these enemies of God have been killed. And then it says, after 3.5 days, the breath of God will come into them. They stood on their feet. Great fear fell on those beholding them. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up into heaven to the clouds, and their enemies beheld them. And then in an hour there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the rest were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. This, the second woe is past. Behold, the third woe is coming. Remember, those last three trumpets were called the three woes. The fifth, the sixth, and finally now we're getting to the seventh trumpet here, the seventh of these woes. And this is the sounding here of the seventh trumpet. And the seventh angel sounded, and there arose loud voices in heaven saying, and this is from Handel's Messiah. Remember, he got this from that. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. The 24 elders fell, who sit on their thrones before God, fell on their faces. By the way, the 24 elders are mentioned 12 times in the book of Revelation. Six of those times we find them falling on their faces before God, saying, we give thanks to thee, O Lord God, the Almighty, the Pantocrator, the one who has his hands on everything, who art and who wast, because thou hast taken thy great power and thou hast begun to reign. In other words, now here the long interlude is over. The moment that all history has been waiting for has now come. And you think about this, what Satan tried to offer Jesus Christ through temptation, Christ has now received through triumph. Where Satan tried to offer Jesus all the kingdoms of the earth through temptation, Jesus has now received those things through triumph. And as you read down through this section here, it's filled with aorist tense verbs, past tense verbs. In other words, this is all being stated as if it's a done deal. In other words, it's certainty that these things will happen. It's as if it's already taken place. And then he says in verse 18, the nations were enraged. The enemies of God are enraged at these things. Rather than submitting to him and trusting him, they're angry. And thy wrath came, and the time came for the dead to be judged, and the time to give the reward to your bondservants, the prophets, and to the saints, and to those who fear thy name, the small and the great, to those who destroy the earth. So this is the time of the reward for Old Testament saints and tribulation saints who will be raised here at the end. And then it says, the temple of God, which is in heaven, was opened. So notice this chapter began with a temple on earth, and now we have a temple in heaven. The temple in chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, we often call the tribulation temple. It's that temple that's going to be built on earth during the time of tribulation. So how do we know there's going to be a temple on earth? Well, there's several passages tell us about it. Remember in Matthew chapter 24, Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, refers to the defiling of that end time temple by the Antichrist. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4 says that the Antichrist is going to sit in the temple of God and declare that he is God. So there's going to be that future temple that's going to be built on the earth that we saw there in chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. By the way, I didn't mention this at the time, but let me say this. A lot of people wonder, how is there going to be a temple built on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem during the end times? I mean, the Dome of the Rocks over there, you know, people say, well, you could maybe build the temple next to it. Well, that's where the temple was. And even if it wasn't in that place, the Jews and the Muslims, neither one are going to want the temple and the Dome of the Rock in the same place. People say, that's impossible. You're going to have a future temple built there. Well, look, people 100 years ago said it's impossible the Jewish people ever get back in their land, but they're there today. And the same God who brought that to pass can bring this to pass as well. So chapter 11, verses 1 and 2 tells us about a tribulation temple, a third Jewish temple that will be built there in Israel during the end times. But when we get down here to chapter 11, verse 19, this is a temple of God in heaven, a heavenly temple. And this temple here, I think, is the prototype of the earthly temple. We see throughout the book of Revelation that God is seated on a throne inside of a temple. And you remember when Moses built the tabernacle and when David received the plans for the temple, they were given to them the pattern from the heavenly to create the earthly down here out of brick and stone and gold and those kinds of things. So there's a heavenly prototype here. And he sees the temple of God in heaven opened, and the ark of his covenant appeared in his temple. And there were flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder and an earthquake and a great hailstone. So again, the ark on the earth pictured the presence of God among men. And there's an ark in heaven that is a prototype of that which is on the earth. And this scene into heaven, the reason this is given to us here, I think, is to remind people again that God's presence is with man, that God's presence is with us to guide us, and that God's presence is with us to direct us. So we've gotten now to the seventh trumpet being sounded here. And the seventh trumpet, I believe, contains the seven bowls that we're going to see later. One other issue I want to deal with here, some people take the seventh trumpet here to be the time of the rapture. Because remember in 1 Corinthians 15, it talks about the last trumpet will sound at the time of the rapture. So a lot of people take this to be the time of the rapture. The problem with equating those two is that the seventh trumpet the last trumpet in 1 Corinthians 15 is the trumpet of God. Here this is a trumpet of an angel. The trumpet here is a trumpet of judgment. The trumpet back in 1 Corinthians 15 is a trumpet of grace. So I don't see these as being equated. The last trumpet in Revelation 15 is the last trumpet of the church age. Not the last trumpet here. They're different in character. So we've gotten to the end here now in chapter 11. We've gotten here now to the seventh trumpet here. But the seventh trumpet contains the seven bowl judgments. But before we get to the seven bowls over in chapter 15, where you have the prelude to those, and then the bowls in chapter 16, what we're going to have now here is in chapters 12 through 14, more fill-in information, more interlude to describe a lot of the main characters that are going to be involved in the end time drama. Israel and Satan and the Antichrist and the false prophet and so on. So we're going to pick up there next time in chapter 12. And chapter 12 of Revelation is going to really be used to hone our hermeneutical skills, because the book of Revelation is the most symbolic book of the Bible, and Revelation chapter 12 is the most symbolic chapter in the most symbolic book of the Bible. So we're really going to have to pull out our hermeneutical skills as we go through this chapter to really understand what these different symbols refer to. I think it'll be a great help to us spiritually, to help us understand the book, but also to try to be consistent in our interpretation, as we're trying to do as we go through the book. So chapter 12, this great sign that John sees, is where we'll pick up next time.